Hi, welcome to the fourth long-awaited, long-delayed episode of the Fire in a Bottle podcast. The topic is reductive stress. I'm the host of this podcast, Brad Marshall, and the author of Fire in a Bottle. I hope you enjoy this episode. It is about reductive stress, which is kind of a complicated subject, but don't worry too much about it. Reduction and oxidation is just a way to describe electrons moving around, and biology is really just electrons moving around, at least the most interesting parts of it. Reduction is gaining electrons, and oxidation is losing electrons. So every time an electron is transferred between two molecules, one is oxidized and the other is reduced. So anyway, we'll talk a lot about that in the episode. Reductive stress, I think, is a huge issue. I think it is hugely important in obesity, diabetes, heart disease, etc. And I think it's only finally becoming much more widely recognized what a big problem it is, and probably is also, sort of ironically, at the root of most of the things that we see that look like oxidative stress begin with reductive stress, in my opinion. Just to show, you've probably all heard a lot about antioxidants and oxidative stress and how great they are. I just did a quick, Google Scholar search to see how many articles have been printed on reductive stress and oxidative stress, just to show how much more oxidative stress has been studied. It has had 508,000 papers reference oxidative stress versus only about 17,000. So that's a ratio. So there's been 30 that mentioned reductive stress. So there's been about 30 papers about oxidative stress published for every one talking about reductive stress. And I believe that reductive stress is the root of the problem. Reductive stress sort of looks like too much energy in the cell. And I think as you go on and listen to this, you'll sort of understand why that is. At the end, I talk about the supplements that are for sale at fireinabottle.net. And if you go there and click on shop, you can see them. And I'll explain at the end sort of why, what my strategy is with these and the best way to use them. And that includes my succinate, which is a form of succinate supplementation. I did mention that there was an article that talks about the rodent studies of the advantages of the succinate on my blog, but I couldn't remember what it was called. And that is obesity as a global succinate dehydrogenase activity deficit, part two, the ROS theory of obesity, part three, part two, in fact, is the full name of that article on the blog. And this episode, to be clear, is pretty much summarizing the articles that I wrote on the blog between around October 12th of 2021 and December 8th of 2021. So if you go to, if you click on where it says blog and then it says searchable, sortable blog index on the Fire in a Bottle blog, you can see the whole kind of compact listing of all those things, and you can just look for those dates. Those are the articles I'm referencing. The one other thing I referenced was an article about Ossabow pigs that I couldn't remember the name of, and that is called Obesity-Prone Pigs Go from Normal to Pathological Insulin Sensitivity to Torpor When Given Enough PUFA. And so if you just go to that searchable, sortable blog index page and search for obesity-prone pigs, that article will pop right up. Okay, that is all that I can think of right now. So without further ado, Fire in a Bottle podcast, part four, reductive stress. So first, what is reduction and what is oxidation? Let's go back to the big picture of Fire in a Bottle. In a chloroplast of a plant, what's happening is the chloroplast is actually using the energy of the sun, and it's taking in CO2, which is carbon and oxygen, and the oxygen wants the electrons shared between the carbon and oxygen molecules a lot more than do the carbon molecules. So in that state of CO2, two carbons bound to one oxygen, the oxygen is controlling all of the, or it has a much stronger grip on the electrons than the carbons do. So in CO2, the oxygen is fully reduced because it's controlling the electrons and the carbons are fully oxidized, which is what happens when oxygen binds to you. You become oxidized. And so we have a term called, well, oil rig is a handy way. It means oxidation is losing and reduction is gaining. So in the case of CO2, oxygen is an electron bully. It shares more of the total electron pool than the carbons do. So oxygen has gained the electrons and is thus reduced, because reduction is gaining electrons and oxidation is losing electrons. And so what happens in the chloroplast is that the chloroplast, like I say, uses the energy of the sun to actually allow the two carbon molecules to share electrons with each other. It essentially kicks out that oxygen. And so when two CO2 molecules come in, rather, well, I guess it takes three CO2 molecules, because that's six carbons total, to build a ring of glucose, which is what happens in the chloroplast. So the plant is taking in CO2, it's making glucose, and then it's kicking out oxygen, O2, which is oxygen's being forced to share electrons with each other, which they don't really want to do. And that's why the chloroplast needs energy from the sun to make that happen, right? And so it's kicking out the oxygen as a waste product of building glucose out of CO2. Then, so you can say that the chloroplast is stripping electrons away from oxygen and giving it to glucose, and the glucose, or at least the carbon molecules of the glucose, are comparatively electron rich compared to how they were in the CO2. And then now in a human, we look at the mitochondria and the opposite thing is happening. The electrons in the glucose are flowing back ultimately to oxygen. And that is that flow of electrons in this case, it's oxidation. The glucose is being oxidized because electrons are flowing to oxygen. And that is, kind of the definition of oxidation. Oxygen likes to take the electrons. And so that is where metabolism starts. And we don't, in our mitochondria, the oxygen does not interact directly with, carbohydrates or starch, right? Like, and you can test this. You can take a piece of bread and set it on the counter and it will not spontaneously, catch on fire due to the oxygen in the atmosphere, right? And so we can pretty easily test the idea that at 100 degrees or whatever our body temperature is, the oxygen does not directly oxidize the bread, right? What does happen? Well, the glucose molecules are actually broken down into something called pyruvate. Pyruvate enters your, which is a three carbon ring, or it's not a ring, it's a three carbon molecule. It's basically half of a glucose. So glucose comes into the cell, it gets split in half in a process called glycolysis. Pyruvate enters the mitochondria, and pyruvate is oxidized in something called the citric acid cycle. It goes around, the drawings of it, of the citric acid cycle, always has it going in a circle, which isn't really true. It's not really spinning in circles. It's just a series of reactions, but it's convenient to draw it that way. It makes sense to humans, What happens is when the three carbon pyruvate, one carbon leaves, it gets converted to something called acetyl-CoA, and it gets tacked onto oxaloacetate to become citric acid. And then the citric acid goes through this series of steps. And at each step, well, there's a bunch of different things that happen, but as it goes around, it's giving off carbon dioxide. Two steps of this cycle, it gives off a carbon dioxide, which brings it back around to being a four-carbon thing again, which is the oxaloacetate, and then it can grab another acetyl-CoA, which is another two-carbon unit, and it, you know, now it has six carbons again, and then there's a series of reactions where it gives off two carbon dioxides, and it gets all the way back to oxaloacetate again. And so those carbon dioxides that the chloroplast took in and stripped the oxygens out of and released them, those carbon dioxides are now being released in your mitochondria, and you're breathing them out. And that's, so you could see the carbon dioxide, right, literally flows into the chloroplast, and you exhale it after a whole series of magical reactions. That's oxidative life in a nutshell. Okay, so what is, just briefly again, what is reduction in the context of mitochondrial science and your metabolism, and what is reductive stress? So every acetyl-CoA that comes in, and you get two acetyl groups from a molecule of glucose, which become acetyl-CoA, or if you eat an 18-carbon fat, which could be stearic acid, or it could be oleic acid, like in olive oil, or it could be linoleic acid, like in vegetable oil, all three of those will give you 9 acetyl-CoA groups. So all of the calories that you consume, ethanol, alcohol, also winds up as acetyl-CoA. So all of the energy that you consume boils down to acetyl-CoA in the mitochondria, and it all has to run through the citric acid cycle to get converted to ATP. And so how does that work? Well, so every time, here's one key thing, every time that you go around that cycle and you give off those two extra carbons as carbon dioxide, it requires 3 NAD plus, 3 molecules of NAD plus. And what happens is they take an electron and they get converted to NADH. What those NADHs do is they carry the electron, again, redox, reduction in oxidation. It's just the movement of electrons. That's all that there is. These things are handing the electron from one molecule to the next, to the next. So don't get overly confused by the terminology. We're literally, it's in your house, when you flip a switch, electrons run through the wires, and that's what turns your lights on. Biological systems are different in that we don't have wires, but essentially all of the energy is still stored in moving electrons, and that's how we get around. That's what life is. And so what's happening is these electron-rich acetyl-CoA molecules are, those electrons are being transferred to NAD+. NAD+ is the oxidized form. It's getting reduced to NADH. Remember, reduction is gaining, and NADH has gained the electrons. And so NADH now has to get rid of those electrons. And so it goes to the electron transport chain. And I've talked a lot about this on my blog in previous episodes, but to summarize, the mitochondria is like a little battery, and these electrons, as they move through the electron transport chain, what happens is the electron transport chain itself, which has these things called complex 1 and complex 2 and complex 3 and complex 4 and complex 5, they pump protons, which is just a positively charged atom. It's just a single, it's the smallest atom in the world. It's the nucleus of a hydrogen atom without its electron. And they get pumped across the mitochondrial membrane, and that creates a positive charge on the outside of the mitochondria and a negative charge on the inside of the mitochondria. And if you burn a lot, if you're doing a lot of metabolism and you burn a lot of fuel, that positive charge on the outside builds up, and then the protons come back down through complex 5, and that is like a huge rotating turbine, and it spins, and it uses that mechanical energy to convert a molecule of ADP into a molecule of ATP. ATP is that bond between adenosine diphosphate has two phosphate groups on it, and then ATP has a third one, and that bond between the second and third phosphate group contains a lot of energy in it. And so when you walk around, when you move your muscles, what's happening is you're breaking that third bond between those two phosphate groups, and that releases energy, and that's what allows you to do stuff. Basically, that's like the chemical energy that all your muscles and your brain and everything runs off of is ATP. And so the more ATP that you use, the more ADP is around, and the faster the protons can come down through ATP synthase, and because you can convert those ATPs right back to ATPs. And so this whole system, though, can sort of build up. You know, if you're not using a lot of energy, if there's a lot of fuel around to burn, all your ADPs are converted to ATPs. You've got a high sort of voltage barrier across your mitochondria. You got a lot of protons on one side. And now, you know, you're doing metabolism. You are converting those NAD pluses to NADHs, right? And so that's reduction. Reduction is getting those electrons off of the carbohydrate or the fat or whatever the initial fuel was and onto NAD plus. So again, NAD plus is the oxidized form. It gets an electron. It becomes NADH, the reduced form. Now, in the scenario that I just said, if you're burning a lot of fuel, whether it's carbohydrates or fat or ethanol, and if you've already converted most of your ADP to ATP, and if the electron barrier is high across the mitochondria, now the NADH still has to get rid of that electron. And the only way it can do it in the reduced form, can get rid of that electron, is by reducing something else. It's got to give that electron to someone. And the only one that it can really give it to is complex 1 of the mitochondrial electron transport chain. So it's going to go over there and it's going to give, you know, it's going to give that electron to complex 1. So that's kind of how it works. And so reductive stress, though, is that scenario that I described where as much ATP that can be generated has already been generated. There's a lot of protons already pumped, and that system just can't move forward. And so what happens is all of the NAD pluses get converted to NADHs. And so when you look at the cells, we define oxidative stress based on the NAD plus to NADH ratio, and we defined reductive stress that way as well, or that's one of the many ways that you can define oxidative and reductive stress. So oxidative stress is a scenario where you have tons and tons of NAD plus, but not any NADH by this metric. Reductive stress is when you have all NADH and you don't have any NAD plus. And so that is, when I talk about reductive stress, I'm defining it as having a high ratio of NADH relative to NAD plus, or basically it's a lack of NAD plus that does not allow you to continue burning fuel because you cannot go around the citric acid cycle because there's no NAD plus to hand the electrons to. And so basically, reductive stress is the lack of oxidized NAD, which is the NAD plus form. Okay, the basketball analogy. Imagine that you're in a small gymnasium, like the small gymnasium in the downstairs of the Lions Elementary School. You probably don't know it, but it's not that big. There's a conveyor belt on one end of the gymnasium, and it's bringing in basketballs. And there's another empty conveyor belt on the other end of the gym, and as it moves out, you can place basketballs on it. So, in the simple scenario, one or two people could simply ferry the basketballs from one conveyor belt to the other conveyor belt, and both of the conveyor belts would have to run at the same speed, and the room wouldn't fill up with basketballs. Now, the incoming conveyor represents the electrons that are coming from the food that you're oxidizing, and the outgoing conveyor belt represents those electrons leave, you know, that's basically your metabolic rate. That's those electrons getting handed off to the electron transport chain, etc. Now, in this simple scenario, of course, the incoming conveyor belt has to run at the same speed as the outgoing conveyor belt, right? You can only oxidize your food as fast as you are burning ATP, using energy, and that is in the rate that you're using the ATP is going to control the conveyor belt that represents your metabolic rate. So, you know, of course, if you go jogging, then you burn more ATP, you burn more fuel, the outgoing conveyor belt goes faster, so you can increase the speed of the incoming conveyor belt, right? But okay, let's assume that we're at rest, and suddenly the room, there's a bunch of people in the room, 20 or so. The number's arbitrary, but we'll say 20. Those people are NAD plus. They don't have a basketball. They are oxidized because oxidation is losing electrons, and the basketball represents the electrons. So for a little while, what you can do is you can burn the fuel faster by simply throwing the basketballs to all of the NAD pluses standing in the room, right? You can run that thing all out, but pretty soon all 20 people are now holding basketballs. They're now NADH. They're reduced because reduction is gaining electrons. So NAD plus and NADH, it's just a molecule that carries electrons. That's all that it is. I mean, it's involved in other pathways. It is has multiple roles in the body. But in this scenario, it's just carrying electrons from point A to point B. And to get rid of those electrons, it has to reduce something else. And that's the thing about these electron-carrying systems, which includes NAD plus and NADH, but also includes glutathione, which they call the body's master antioxidant, which can exist in either the oxidized or reduced states. And remember that antioxidants are electron donors. So antioxidants are something that would convert NAD plus to NADH. I don't know if that specific reaction happens, but theoretically, antioxidants are something that are reduced and they're going to give something an electron. And so the only way for one of the NADHs in the room to get back to NAD plus, of course, is they have to be able to put a basketball on the outgoing conveyor belt. Now, what are they doing? They're giving electrons to something else, reducing it. Now, in the mitochondria, this happens to at complex one of the mitochondrial electron transport chain. NADH is reducing complex one, and that's what allows the proton pumping and ultimately ATP generation. But like I say, if we're not burning a lot of ATP, the rate that conveyor belt is going is going to slow down. You can only add so many basketballs to the conveyor belt if the room on the other side of the wall that holds the basketballs that we can't see is also full of basketballs, right? There are physical limits to kind of how many electrons can be shuttled through this system. And that's kind of how oxidizing our food is related to our metabolic rate. Okay, now, a side door enters, and in comes another human. This time the human represents a molecule of oxygen. We toss that human a ball. Boom, we've got reduced oxygen. Oxygen, so NAD plus starts off with a positive charge because it lacks an electron, right? So it's positively charged because it's lacking a negative charge. So when you give NAD plus an electron, it becomes NADH, which is positively charged. It technically picks up two electrons and a proton, but don't worry about it. It's just electrons moving. But the oxygen is special. When the oxygen is reduced, it becomes O2 minus, and it really becomes O2 dot minus. And the dot represents the fact that it has an unpaired electron in its outer shell. And that is the definition of a free radical. So we have now, by passing a basketball to oxygen, we have now created superoxide. Every other of these redox just meaning reduction and oxidation, and pairs because, you know, they can cycle back and forth between NAD plus and NADH. So NAD plus and NADH are a redox pair. Glutathione is the same. And all of these, NAD and glutathione, have to reduce something else to get rid of the basketball so that you can toss another basketball to them from your conveyor. Superoxide is special. When oxygen comes in, catches the first basketball, the oxygen actually takes someone else's basketball and leaves. And so the net result of you throwing one basketball to oxygen is that you can now throw a second basketball to one of the NAD pluses, and no balls even need to go on to the conveyor belt because the oxygen gets the reducing the oxygen the first time causes it to go to an enzyme called superoxide dismutase, where it gets reduced a second time into hydrogen peroxide. And then glutathione reduces hydrogen peroxide a third time. And when it does that, it converts a molecule of NADPH into NADP+. And that sounds a lot like NAD+, and it is a lot like NAD+. And there's a system where in the mitochondria, those NADP pluses are converted to NAD pluses. So every other time that you reduce a superoxide, you get an NAD plus back. And that is the magic of superoxide. So superoxide is sort of a relief valve that releases the reductive stress. Remember, reductive stress is the state where the metabolic, you know, outgoing conveyor belt is full of balls and everyone in the room is holding a ball, and you can't burn any more fuel because there's nowhere for electrons to to flow to. That's reductive stress. Superoxide relieves the reductive stress because reducing superoxide one time leads to two more reductions of oxygen. And this all works because oxygen loves electrons. And that is how, and so that is the magic of superoxide. One reduction reaction leads to a chain of reduction reactions. And that is why superoxide regenerates NAD+ in a way that no other sort of reduction reactions can. So now you're feeling depressed because it sounds like what I've just described is a very calories in, calories out view of the world where your metabolic rate is tied to, you know, burning of ATP essentially. And it sounds like I'm saying that, you know, move more, eat less is the solution, but I don't actually believe that. So we have at least two known ways out of this reductive stress. The first one is, and what I'm talking about is, you know, just your metabolic rate when you're sitting at rest. I believe that there can be huge variations in this. This can be shown in mice who lack SCD1. So SCD1 is a gene that converts saturated fat to monounsaturated fat. And the part of this electron transport chain that I have not talked about yet is complex 2. What happens is that in the cycle of beta oxidation, which is breaking fats down, each time you go around, you have electrons that are handed to something called succinate dehydrogenase, which is complex 2 of the electron transport chain. Mice that lack SCD1 have very saturated fat and very small amounts of unsaturated fats, which is sort of two different ways of saying the same thing. And saturated fat has more input to succinate dehydrogenase, aka complex 2. Complex 1 and complex 2 both, right, they both become reduced. Complex 1 becomes reduced by NADH. Complex 2 becomes reduced by something called FADH2, aka succinate dehydrogenase. Those things in turn have to reduce something else so that they can get back to the oxidized form so that they can get reduced again by another molecule of NADH or FADH2, as the case may be. And so the only way that, like I said, things that are reduced have to reduce something else to get back to the oxidized state. They have to give off their electrons, right? They have to hand their electrons to someone else. And that's how it works. And so they both have to hand their electrons to something called coenzyme Q. And the problem is if you've got a lot of electrons coming in through complex 1 and a lot of electrons coming in through complex 2, coenzyme Q can get overloaded. And that is when electrons ping back out through complex 1 and they become free floating electrons. And what happens is, as I've said, oxygen loves electrons. And so oxygen will soak up these free electrons and it will become reduced because reduction is gaining electrons. So now you have reduced oxygen, O2 minus, and it has a negative charge because it has an extra electron. It's also called O2 dot minus is the full sort of way that it's written. And the dot represents the fact that it has an unpaired electron in its outer shell. And O2 dot minus is also called superoxide. It's a reactive oxygen species. It is a free radical. The definition of a free radical is something with an unpaired electron in its outer shell. And so electrons like to be paired. And so having this unpaired electron makes superoxide quite reactive. And it gets converted by something called superoxide dismutase to hydrogen peroxide. And that step is actually where the magic happens. What I've been saying all along is that for things to become, for things that are reduced, NADH, it has to reduce something else to get back to NAD+, which is the oxidized form of NADH, right? It has this extra electron. It has to give it to something. Same thing is true of glutathione, which is going to enter the story in a second. You have oxidized glutathione and you have a reduced glutathione, and to get, for the reduced glutathione to get back to the oxidized glutathione, it has to give those electrons to someone. So I lost my train of thought for a second. It happens. back to superoxide. So what's unique about superoxide? Well, oxygen really, really likes electrons. So in the case of oxygen, when it picks up an electron, it doesn't give it to anyone because it's oxygen. What it does is superoxide dismutase actually gives, well, it really, what it does is it takes a first molecule of superoxide and, sorry, it's going to be technical for a second, has a manganese at its core, and the first molecule of superoxide reduces the manganese within the superoxide dismutase. So we're not like breaking any of the chemical laws here. Superoxide still does reduce something. It's the manganese at the center of the superoxide dismutase, but then a second superoxide and hits, you know, bumps into superoxide dismutase. And here's where the magic does happen. The manganese now reduces the second superoxide a second time. So in every case up until now, when a molecule gets reduced, it can only get back to the oxidized state by reducing something else. But superoxide is special. When it gets every other superoxide molecule that gets reduced winds up getting reduced a second time, again, because it's oxygen and it loves electrons. So now it gets reduced again to hydrogen peroxide. And then hydrogen peroxide gets converted to water by glutathione, which they call the body's master antioxidant. Antioxidants are electron donors. And so what's happening is the hydrogen peroxide is now being reduced once again. So that initial reduction of superoxide causes that oxygen to be reduced two more times itself. And so that oxygen molecule is removing the reductive stress by just absorbing electron after electron after electron. And at the end, it's just water. So, and what happens is that glutathione, once it reduces the oxygen, it becomes oxidized, and now it needs to become reduced again before it can reduce another molecule of hydrogen peroxide. And there's an enzyme that does that, and it actually uses something called NADPH. And the process of reducing the glutathione actually converts the NADPH to an NADP+. Now, you may think that sounds a lot like NADH and NAD+, and it is. They're almost the same thing. And so, right, so when superoxide is generated, it causes NADP+ to be generated. And then I have a blog post called ROS as a thermogenic loop. I believe that's what it's called. That's off the top of my head. But there's another enzyme called NNT, and what it does is it converts the NADP+ to NAD+. And so what ends up happening is the generation of superoxide winds up creating NAD+. That's the take home message. And it's because of the fact that oxygen is the ultimate electron hog. Once it gets that first electron, it just keeps taking and taking. And reductive stress, which is what you see in obesity and diabetes and heart disease and all these other problems, is essentially caused by too many electrons to go around. And the way that you get rid of some of those extra electrons and allow your metabolism to keep flowing at a normal rate is you have to generate superoxide. And that will, like, the generation of superoxide can eliminate your reductive stress. And yeah, and so that is where you need to have input to complex 2, succinate dehydrogenase. You need to have, to increase your metabolic rate the most, you want to have a lot of input through both complex 1 and complex 2. And to bring it back to the SCD1 deficient mice. So again, these are mice who cannot unsaturate their own fat. Their fat is very saturated. They have a metabolic rate something like 40% higher than normal mice. They have a very high ratio of NAD+ to NADH, aka they are very much not in reductive stress. They have a high metabolic rate. They're nearly totally resistant to diet-induced obesity and diabetes. And then, you know, there's more evidence of this. The strain of mice that is commonly used in diet-induced obesity models, because they're really easy to make fat, actually lack the gene NNT. And that's the gene that's the enzyme that regenerates NAD+ from NADP+. And those mice have lower metabolic rates than normal mice and are much more prone to diet-induced obesity. And you can take NNT and you can put it in a cell line and you can overexpress it. And the cells in that tissue culture will have a higher metabolic rate. They'll burn more oxygen. And so you see very direct effects between this enzyme, NNT, that is recycling NAD+ from using superoxide, and metabolic rate. So in biology, it's always fun to look at a problem from lots of different angles. So we could ask the question another way, instead of asking how might we get out of reductive stress, the question is how might we get into reductive stress if we wanted to. And those of you who are longtime followers of the blog and this podcast know that I love to talk about torpor, which is an alternative metabolic rate that mammals go into when they want to hibernate or when they want to maintain energy reserves, because there are something like 180 species of mammal who have the ability to hibernate, which suggests that whoever the first mammal was, they already had the full suite of, you know, genes or whatever that would allow them to enter this alternative metabolic state called torpor, which is a way, you know, because there are a lot of advantages to having a warm-blooded metabolism. We can get around on cold days. We can do a lot of things that, you know, cold-blooded animals like reptiles just can't do. But the disadvantage is it takes a lot of calories. And so we have this built-in program to turn off or to turn down our metabolic rate so that we can conserve fuel. And if you look at there's an article on my blog called "The Hibernating Mammals Respond to Linoleic Acid the Same Way Humans Do," something along those lines. If you go to my blog, by the way, which is fireinabottle.net, and click the blog link, it takes you to a blog index that you can search, and you can also sort by date. So if you search for hibernating mammals or hibernating animals, I think it's hibernating mammals, boom, that article will come right up and you can click on it. And what that article talks about is if you take a hibernating ground squirrel and you take it into the lab and you give one group of them enough vegetable oil, aka linoleic acid, aka polyunsaturated fat, they will, and then you reduce the day length and turn on the air conditioner, it gets cold, and then you withhold their food, they will begin to hibernate. And they'll hibernate through the entire, you know, 6 month period or however long they hibernate for. If you take another group and you don't feed them the polyunsaturated fat, you just feed them starch, they can become just as fat before winter as the, or nearly as fat as the ones given the vegetable oil. But they, when the day length gets short, when the air gets cold and you take the food away, they fail to hibernate. And in fact, they burn off their entire winter's fuel reserves in 9 days was all that it took. And they never hibernate. And so we know that this sort of alternative lowered metabolic rate is tied to the consumption of vegetable oil. And we also know that obesity in humans is tied to this gene called SCD1, the same one that when the mice don't make it, they have very high metabolic rates and remain very lean. When you look at obese humans, they make a lot of SCD1 and they're converting their saturated fat into monounsaturated fat. And so looked at from the perspective of NNT and superoxide, unsaturated fat make less superoxide than does saturated fat because there is less input into complex 2, aka succinate dehydrogenase. And like I said, when you have a lot of NADH input to complex 1 and a lot of FADH2 complex into complex 2, that is what you've got electrons coming in from both sides, and it overwhelms coenzyme Q. They both have to reduce coenzyme Q to offload their electrons. And that's when you have electrons pinging back out, leading to superoxide, leading to NNT, leading to NAD+, leading to a high NAD+ to NADH ratio, leading to a high metabolic rate. And so if you are eating lots of vegetable oils over time, that will click on your SCD1 gene. You can see that, again, there's an article on my blog called, search for the word Ossabaw, O-S-S-A-B-A-W. There's a really interesting study involving pigs where they gave them two different types of soybean oil, and one of them was all linoleic acid, and one of them had a bit of triply unsaturated linolenic acid, very, very polyunsaturated fat. And those pigs, they got the extra polyunsaturated fat. They clicked on the unsaturated fat, clicked on their SCD1 gene, and their saturated fat levels drop pretty dramatically, and their monounsaturated fat levels increased. And that's the same thing that we see in, you know, actual walking around obese humans is high expression of SCD1 and lots of monounsaturated fat. And so this kind of balancing of saturated or saturation levels of your stored body fat seems to be a huge player in this game of, are you going to have a torpid metabolism or are you going to have a hot-blooded metabolism? And of course, I talk in my blog, there's an article about starch eaters. If you search for starch eaters on the blog index, you'll find it. And that's about how, ironically, the body fat of human cultures where they subsist primarily on starch. So this might be a Chinese peasant eating white rice. It might be an African farmer eating manioc, or aka cassava, I think. Those people are both going to have very, very highly saturated fat, ironically, much higher than Americans do. And so, and when you look at them, they have very high metabolic rates and they remain lean. Americans have unsaturated fat and we become obese. And sure, there's other reasons for it, but I think that that's a primary player. Now, to finish up the story about torpor and NAD+, we have enzymes called sirtuins, and sirtuins are deacetylases. One of the ways that we control our enzyme systems in our body is this thing called post-translational modification. Sorry for the jargon. What that means is we have genes that live in our DNA, and the genes code for enzymes. Well, they code for a lot of things, but one of the things they code for is enzymes. And we have the gene gets transcribed into an RNA, an mRNA. mRNA has been in the news recently. You probably have heard the word. The mRNA codes for a gene. And we then, quote, transcribe the mRNA into a protein, which in this case is an enzyme. And enzymes are just proteins that catalyze reactions. And so in the case of, well, I think NAD is actually a good example of this. So in the case of NAD, what happens is, right, so let me back up again to post-translational modification. So what that means is, and a lot of times in biological systems, we turn off enzymes simply by sticking other small molecules to them. And that seems kind of weird. And there's all kinds of versions of this. There's methylation. A methyl group is just methane is just CH4, right? And that's one of the greenhouse gases. So if you take one of those hydrogens off, it becomes CH3, and that's a methyl group, and you stick that onto the active site of a protein, and, you know, it's like jamming something into your key slot. You can't get the door open anymore. And so there's all kinds of these post-translational modifications of these enzymes. There's like biotinylation and succinylation, and anyway, acetylation is a very common one, and acetylation, acetyl group is, again, it's just another small molecule. And it seems to happen, it seems that enzymes get acetylated kind of spontaneously. It's just a reaction that's just happening. I don't think it requires an enzyme. I think it just kind of happens for whatever reason. And it usually happens on a specific amino acid, lysine. It doesn't really matter. And some of the enzymes that get acetylated are succinate dehydrogenase, aka complex 2, NNT, the thing that gives you NAD plus back from superoxide. Also, I believe complex 5, the thing that allows you to produce ATP. And there are enzymes that come along and they reduce the acetyl groups from your other enzymes in your mitochondria. And so obviously, if your complex 2 is acetylated, your NNT is acetylated, your complex 5 is acetylated, you're going to have a very low metabolic rate. You're going to be low energy. You're not going to have a lot of ATP because ATP synthase is acetylated. They're all turned off. Like this is mitochondrial dysfunction. When all your enzymes are not working, right? You can't generate superoxide because complex 2 is acetylated, and you need that complex 2 or succinate dehydrogenase activity to drive the superoxide in the first place to recycle the NAD+. And then furthermore, you also need NNT to get you back the NAD+, and that's also acetylated. And it's not 100% of them are never acetylated. But what you see is in obese people and in hibernating animals in a state of torpor, you see that their enzymes become highly acetylated, especially succinate dehydrogenase, complex 2. And so And so, okay, so why does that happen and what prevents it? Well, guess what? The sirtuins are NAD plus dependent deacetylases. So the sirtuin enzymes, and there are seven of them, they will take those acetyl groups off of your enzymes and get your mitochondria functioning again. And of course, maybe you heard it, the key phrase in all this is NAD plus dependent. So the sirtuins use NAD plus as a cofactor, which is to say that if you are in a state of reductive stress, which you are obese, you almost certainly are, you are going to have low sirtuin activity, and therefore your mitochondrial enzymes are going to be acetylated, and you're going to have, you know, you're going to have a low metabolic rate, sort of per cell. That's what's going to happen. And so you have to generate some NAD plus to activate some sirtuins to get your mitochondrial enzymes, you know, up and running again so that you can, you know, burn some fat, right? That's kind of what it boils down to. And so that is, yeah. And so that's just another way that reductive stress, lack of complex two, lack of succinate dehydrogenase is building up. And the last thing I want to say on this part is that when animals go into hibernation, one of the first things that happen is they lower succinate dehydrogenase activity via acetylation. When they, in the days preceding them coming out of torpor, they absolutely surge the levels of sirtuins that they're producing. So they have like a sevenfold surge in sirtuin production when they want to get out of hibernation, because they've got to get those mitochondrial enzymes deacetylated and running again so that they can burn a bunch of fuel, increase their body temperature, and be able to get up and walk around again and have a normal metabolic rate. So you see this sort of, again, you see reflected, you see a similar state in obesity as you see in torpor and hibernating animals. And of course, we evolved from mammals who could go into torpor and did go into torpor, and we probably have those same systems in place. Okay, so you're obese, you're maybe diabetic or pre-diabetic, or for whatever reason, you know, maybe you have low body temperature, maybe you're low energy. All of these things can be symptoms of being in reductive stress. You have low levels of ATP because you're low in NAD plus, and so your ATP synthase is acetylated. That causes low energy, right? You have low energy if you have low ATP. That's what happens. You're obese. You're doing a lot of de novo lipogenesis. This is all caused by reductive stress. So you're wondering, how do we get out of it? So one thing that I've been recommending on my blog, and I'm actually a huge fan of, is something called alpha-lipoic acid. This is something that we make in our mitochondria, and it's actually a mitochondrial cofactor, or an enzyme cofactor to some really interesting enzymes. There's, like, for instance, it's a coenzyme for an enzyme that is involved in breaking down branched chain amino acids. And when you look at obese people, they have higher levels of circulating branched chain amino acids. And for whatever reason, branched chain amino acids are used preferentially as a fuel for doing de novo lipogenesis, which is to say, making fat, right? The branched chain amino acids are very preferentially become starting points for making fat. And the reason that you have high circulating branched-chain amino acids is probably not that your diet is high in branched-chain amino acids. It's that you're not making enough lipoic acid, and you're not metabolizing the branched-chain amino acids, and they're building up and they're becoming fat. So this alpha lipoic, and that's how alpha lipoic is, lipoic acid is used endogenously. It's sort of not clear if alpha lipoic acid, by the way, is a very cheap supplement. There's a lot of studies showing that it's good for diabetes. You can probably get it just at Walmart, but it's relatively inexpensive. I've been taking anywhere from 2,400 to sometimes I've been taking a lot of it some days. You don't necessarily have to do the same, but I found it pretty. One of the things that people complain about, and so here's what it does when you take it as a supplement. It's fairly rapidly, within a matter of 1 to 4 hours, let's say, transported into your cells and into your mitochondria, and you actually eat it in the oxidized form. It gets transported into your mitochondria and into your cells, into your cytoplasm, and it gets reduced. So things like NADH, right? They can only become NAD plus again by reducing something. So when you consume oxidized alpha lipoic acid, it's an oxidant, and your NADH can hand that electron off to alpha lipoic acid, converting it back to NAD plus. Now, a lot of people have asked me, do I think that taking NAD plus supplements is a good idea? And I don't really. And the reason is that if you look at obese people, they tend to have very large pools of these redox buffers. They have a lot of glutathione. They have a lot of lactate, which is another indication of that you're in reductive stress, is you have a lot of lactate. And so I feel like reducing the pool size is less important than giving some substrate that those NADHs can dump off their NA, you know, their Hs and become NAD pluses again. And that those NAD pluses, of course, will get your sirtuins working again. Once your sirtuins are working, then your succinate dehydrogenase and your ATP synthase will become more active, right? And once that happens, then you can start to drive superoxide production at your electron transport chain, right? And so the idea is the alpha lipoic acid is there to create some NAD plus to get things going again. And that is, and by the way, there's tons of confusion about what people call antioxidants. Like alpha lipoic acid is not an antioxidant, it's an oxidant. Even though if you Google it, it'll say it's an antioxidant. And in fact, once it becomes reduced, it can actually act as an antioxidant, but it seems like you eliminate it fairly rapidly. It seems like you eat the oxidized alpha lipoic acid, goes into cells, it gets reduced, and then it gets eliminated mostly through urine. And oh, by the way, it gives you that smell of asparagus pea, because that is from the sulfur elements that are in both alpha lipoic acid and in asparagus. So you're welcome, if you like that smell. So that's alpha lipoic acid, and I think it's really good, and I think it is a great starting place. And then, you know, now so you take the alpha lipoic acid, you're driving some NAD plus, maybe you're getting your mitochondria flowing a little better, and now we can think about adding some things that will increase complex 2 activity, succinate dehydrogenase activity. And my new product that I have on the website, fireinabottle.net, just click on shop, is succinate, which is, it tastes kind of like lemonade. My friend called it lemonade, tastes like lemonade for astronauts, which is a reasonable approximation of what it tastes like. It's like really bad tang. I don't know. Succinate itself is very, very sour. It's in the citric acid cycle and it tastes like citric acid. It's just pungently sour. And so I kind of use some of that and I use some different things to make it taste lemonade-y. And that seemed to work. And there's a scoop in there and you basically just take, I've been taking 2 full scoops a day. I don't usually eat in the morning. So I'll take 1 scoop, stir it into like 6 to 8 ounces of water. Drink that in the morning, and then I do the same before dinner. And right, because the problem is even if you can generate some NAD plus and get your mitochondria working a little better, if your body is still composed of unsaturated fats, you're still not going to be generating superoxide, and you're gonna, as soon as that bit of lipoic acid is gone, and like I say, it turns over pretty quickly, so you eliminate it pretty fast. As soon as it's gone, you're going to go right back to having a reductive stress if you can't generate superoxide. And most of us have very unsaturated body fats. And so in the morning when you wake up and you've been fasted overnight, you're burning your unsaturated body fat, and that's going to give you reductive stress. And so that is the idea of combining the alpha lipoic acid and the succinate. Obviously, I also sell, well, you may or may not know, I also have stearic acid, which is an 18 carbon saturated fat. And like I say, out of every fat, the stearic acid has the highest complex 2 input, succinate dehydrogenase input, or FADH2 input, if you prefer, compared to any other fat out there, up at like 0.49. But having said that, succinate, the FADH2 ratio of succinate is 1.0, so it's even higher than the stearic acid is. And it's probably absorbed faster. And there's a good article, I don't have my blog in front of me, unfortunately, recently, that goes through all of the experimental evidence of the advantages of succinate in mice that ranged from increased muscle mass, more fast twitch oxidative muscles, which are the really good kind of muscles that you want, rapid weight loss, lower body fat content. There were more longer endurance, higher grip strength, longer endurance and exercise training. And this is all just from adding succinate to their diet. So there's some really good, at least in animal models, there's some really good evidence for adding succinate. And you can do it just by drinking lemonade, it turns out. And of course, and I don't mean to downplay the stearic acid. People have had great results with the stearic acid. Dave has a recipe for a stearic acid smoothie, which is in the podcast number 3, the episode of this, in the intro, I give Dave's smoothie recipe. So check that out as well if you like smoothies. And then the last thing that I have is sterculia oil. And that is a tropical oil, which is a natural inhibitor of the enzyme SCD1. So the sterculia oil will prevent you from converting your own body fat to unsaturated fat. And that seems to be best taken at about, it comes with a little dropper bottle, basically 2 dropper fulls a day in the evening. I've been taking at mealtime. That I wouldn't go more than that. I think that's a pretty good dose for someone. And that is pretty much the summary of what we got. And I hope this didn't sound too crazy. And let me know what you guys think. Thanks.